Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me on the roundtable this week, we have Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hello. Happy Monday.
And Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Good morning.
And Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Welcome back, Shane.
Good morning. Hope everyone has their digits after this 4th of July weekend.
Oh, man. Yeah. Okay. So rather than starting with the 4th of July, we're going to start with fracking. So let's start with a boisterous meeting that happened last week. It was an Oil and Gas Land Management Commission meeting. And to set the scene, here is some chanting that happened at the meeting.
Off our land! Hands off our land!
So that hands off our land, that is audio from you, Sarah. These meetings have grown quite contentious, environmental activists chanting and yelling at the commissioners. Your story called some of it heckling. So can you tell me more about this? That seems like a lot for a commission meeting.
Yeah, but it's not the first time that this has happened. So this has been going on for a couple years now. Basically, Governor Mike DeWine signed a bill into law that cleared the way for the state to lease the mineral rights under Ohio's public lands and state parks. And that was in 2022 or early 2023. So there's a group called Save Ohio Parks, and they are opposed to fracking under state parks. So pretty much quarterly, this Oil and Gas Land Management Commission meets. They make decisions about what land is going to be opened up to nominations, and then they make decisions on the bids to actually frack under the land, because basically different private companies bid on the land, and then the state has to pick the highest and best bid. So that was one of these meetings, and it was my first time actually going to a meeting, but I'm told that the folks with Save Ohio Parks go to every meeting, and they are, you know, a pretty boisterous crowd. They protest. They typically have a press conference beforehand. There's songs oftentimes, and then they go into the meeting and they disrupt commissioners at points. I mean, nobody was arrested. Nobody really got out of their seats and got super aggressive, although I will say there was one person who was making some pretty aggressive screams. I don't want to say that they verged into threats, but they were pretty aggressive. Mm-hmm. And they basically chant over the commissioners. So it can be hard to hear what the commissioners are actually voting on at points.
Kathy Cohen Becker leads the group Save Ohio Parks, and she spoke about the environmental effects of drilling. We also have some audio from your story where she addresses their outcry and their outreach. Let's listen.
Our voices are quite loud, and it's quite obvious the comments. We've had over 10,000 public comments since this began, almost like 99% opposed, and it hasn't made a dent.
So I guess maybe some of the yelling is because they're frustrated. If they have that many comments, but the commission keeps approving the drilling, is that what's happening?
Yeah, and I will say, to be very clear, this commission has been given its orders essentially by the state. And I mean, they're part of the state, of course. They're an agency of the state. But when state lawmakers passed this law, it basically put the onus on the Ohio Department of Natural Resources and also the Ohio Department of Transportation, because there is some land. It's not just land under state parks. It's also land under rights of way, you know, plurals. But, you know, this state law change means that these groups kind of have to open up this land in some way. So when I was talking to Cowan Becker, I asked her, you know, you guys have been protesting at these meetings and, you know, obviously to no avail. And I will say it's not like it's hundreds and hundreds of people. This group is a couple dozen, but they are certainly committed and they're there. And generally public opinion of fracking under state parks, they say, is not good. People are not saying we love this idea. But Republicans who supported this law change say that they did it because it gives the state more avenues to collect more revenue. It's opening up another avenue for revenue. And also because they say that the state wants to be one that is open to all types of energy, to bolstering all types of energy. So, you know, Cowan Becker told me she doesn't see a real change happening until an administration change. Governor DeWine has obviously been at least silently supportive of this because he signed the law. Mm-hmm. He hasn't spoken out against it in any way, shape, or form. He's not taken a meeting with this group. Cowan-Becker says they've been talking with candidates, but I will say Vivek Ramaswamy, the Republican gubernatorial candidate, quote tweeted an article about this meeting and, you know, basically put a stamp of approval on it. So if Ramaswamy wins, I imagine it's going to be a continuation of what's currently happening.
And Jeremy or Shane, we can bring you in here to talk about the money. I mean, this brings money into state coffers. Can you talk about, you know, why the state over the years has wanted more oil and gas drilling?
Well, for one thing,
for money.
State lawmakers are always looking for more ways to bring in money, especially when it aligns with something that they ideologically agree with. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Republican lawmakers agree with is increasing energy production in Ohio. And so this is a win-win. It increases more. You get more energy production by drilling. And the state gets royalties from this money, or something like 12.5% as a baseline. And that's money that can be used then to help ODNR, the Department of Natural Resources. Mm-hmm. And to the point, I think at least in the last budget, slipping back on how much money is given to ODNR from the state's normal revenue fund to just for operations. And so I think that's what the trend is, at least.
Shane, do you know more about the ODNR money?
They've been sinking a lot of some of the royalties they've been getting. They've been sinking back into the parks themselves, where the drilling is going on. At Salt Fork has already had some activity going on, and they've already started taking some of that royalty money and turning it around and sinking it back into making improvements. And it helps out ODNR because, like many state agencies, they've got a lot of deferred maintenance. So this kind of helps. Instead of having to go, you know, hat in hand to the General Assembly every budgetary and say, give us some money so we can, you know, fix up our restrooms and make these improvements, now they have this pot of money that they can draw from.
I want to put a finer point on that, though, because I believe Jeremy started to talk about it. There are these royalties coming in, but last year, when lawmakers were preparing the budget, they actually cut ODNR's Parks and Recreation budget by 50% in 2026, and then they used the royalty money to backfill that general revenue fund cut.
So it's not necessarily extra money.
So it's not. Yeah. In some ways, it's extra money. And for fiscal year 2027, it was only a 13% cut. But, you know, there were conservationists who told me they were really, really concerned by that, because once you get general revenue fund money cut by a legislature, it's hard to go back and say, I need this increase, because it looks like an increase, even if it isn't. So I know that's a little confusing, but basically, ODNR didn't get its budget cut. It still got the same amount of money, but where that money was coming from was not just general revenue fund taxpayer dollars. And there are, again, conservationists who are concerned about this, because these parks were established in the same way the national parks were, for conservation efforts. And so, you know, there's a lot of land in Ohio, and they say, why are we drilling under like the 1 or 2% of land that is protected in Ohio or supposed to be protected?
Well, I do know that Salt Fork State Park has been getting renovations, because I happen to have been there over the weekend. So they have a brand new Eco Discovery Center that they opened. And then the beach area of the park is getting a major renovation. Long overdue major renovation. So I guess, but that is happening because of the backfill of the budget cut with the fracking money. Is that right?
Yeah. And yeah. Again, they are. I mean, the state is, it's complicated, but these royalties were kind of tied up and lawmakers had to release them, and they ended up backfilling some of them. But you're right that the parks that are accepting the drilling, and I think it's only one state park right now
Salt Fork is being drilled under.
The rest of them are wildlife areas. But
The Egypt Valley Wildlife Area, which is in that same area, Belmont and Harrison County, and then the Jockey Hollow Wildlife Area, which is in Athens,
yeah,
I believe.
It's all rural, more rural Southeast Ohio areas. And, you know, on the flip side, there's this benefit because these parks are potentially seeing upgrades. But at the same time, going back to what these environmentalists are saying, they're worried about the environmental impacts. You're going to a park, you're spending time outside, and now suddenly you can hear drilling, or there's pollution in the air that impacts the animals that you might be able to see at the park. So kind of a give and take, I guess. But clearly the state has seen the benefit and weighed the benefit over the cost.
Yeah, the drilling is... I didn't see it. I couldn't see it. Of like, course. Yeah. I
mean, they have adjacent. It's adjacent.
It's and not. You won't see any fracking activity on the surface on state land. It's adjacent, and they go under the state land to get the.
So they go horizontal.
Horizontal drilling.
It's why it's not the land rights. It's the mineral rights
under
it's
the land.
It's under the land.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking about fracking and a state commission that awards bids to frack under public lands. And we're talking with Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, and Shane Stegmiller with Hannah News Service. Do we know if this commission has ever turned down any bidders? Like, what do we know about the companies winning these bids? Does everyone who bids wins?
Well, no. I'm sorry, and I didn't mean to cut you off, Shane. No. But there are a lot of these bids. There were multiple bids on the land, so it goes to the best and highest bidder. And, you know, even at this meeting last week, there were some nominations turned down. I wasn't entirely clear why. I asked ODNR, and I think potentially it was because there was some confusion about overlap with what land had already been bid out at Egypt Valley. Because at this point, most of Salt Fork State Park, the mineral rights, have been leased out. The nominations are when the state votes to actually open up the land, and then the bids are when they pick the company. But there are, in a lot of cases, multiple companies bidding on these different projects.
The thing I was going to add to is I think there's also been some nominations that have been rejected or they haven't opened up because of possible like right-of-ways involving high federal highways, and that the Ohio Department of Transportation has previously told this panel that it's barred from approving energy development along federal interstates without getting approval of the Federal Highway Administration, so that some of these other areas might not have gotten at least opened up for nominations because of that issue.
Mm-hmm. However, to your question, Amy, it seems that the policy is designed more about to be in presumption of issuing these permits. And if there's technical reasons not to do so, as Shane and Sarah have laid out, then okay, well, they'll shoot it down. But it's not like on ideological grounds they'll say, oh, well, this state park is too beautiful and we're not going to allow it to be fracked under. That's not really what they're doing.
And I don't know that they could, right? I mean, exactly. The state law is the state law. These commissioners are kind of just the rubber stamp on the process to actually open up the land.
Because the background to this is that the state actually voted more than a decade ago to open this up. But John Kasich, the governor at the time, and Mike DeWine, at least during the first couple of years of his time as governor, didn't do anything about it. Mm. And so a few years ago, lawmakers voted to say, well, we're going to force you to do it by passing a law saying that any nomination will be automatically accepted unless the administration gets going on this. So now the administration is getting going on this. And it's not automatically accepted now, as, again, Shane and Sarah said, but there's a presumption that they will be accepted if it's a reasonable bid.
Hmm. And I also was reading about like the abandoned oil and gas wells around the state. There's an oil and gas well fund that's used to plug abandoned wells. And lawmakers have dipped into this fund in the past, but there's a new law seeking to protect the fund. But is this a problem? Do we have like once you get all the minerals out, then we end up having like an abandoned well?
We do. It's a huge problem. There's tens of thousands of these wells around the state. Some of them have been abandoned for decades, and it leaches chemicals petrochemicals into the nearby water and the air, methane. It's a problem just because it creates sinkholes sometimes, so there's physical issues with it, and it's costly to deal with these and cap these abandoned wells.
So the companies come in and do the drilling, but they don't have to cap it off when they're done?
Well, I mean...
Maybe they don't do it right.
I think there's a variety of reasons that they're not dealt with, but the upshot is that they're not dealt with. And sometimes, you know, companies get sold or the land changes hands, and then the upshot is that there's this remediation fund, as you were saying. And in the past, they've dipped into it to pay for a variety of things. Like the most recent time they did it to pay for this All Ohio Future Fund, which is an economic development fund. Mm. So Senate Bill 219, which Governor just signed a few days ago, actually prohibits that dipping into it. But 219 is actually a much broader bill. That's only one of the parts of this bill. It also has a number of other provisions designed to speed up applications of drilling, and more specifically drilling under state parks and wildlife areas.
Okay, so this bill that was signed into law is wide-ranging. So it speeds up the permitting process to allow for more fracking more quickly, but then it also does things about plugging up the, you know, like any bill that goes through the legislature, there's a lot of pieces and parts to it. The law goes into effect in mid-September, but it seems like it puts a lot more on state regulators. Do state regulators have to pay more attention with this bill, or is it just that they're speeding everything up, and is there more regulation or less regulation with this bill?
It's most of it is designed to speed it up.
Okay. So I guess that would be less regulation if we're speeding it up.
Like, for example, it requires ODNR and other state agencies to finalize approved oil and gas leases within 60 days. Mm. It cuts times for state regulators to review oil and gas leases or proposals, pardon me. And it requires regulators to either issue or deny a drilling permit. It allows a more expedited permit request. So an agency can't refuse a request for an expedited permit. They have to either say yes or no based on the merits, but they can't say, we're too busy right now, so we're not going to expedite. We don't have the time to expedite your request. They mm-hmm. can't do that anymore.
So, Sarah, it sounds like the Save Our Parks Committee that we talked about at the beginning is going to have more work to do here if there's going to be faster permitting.
Yeah, I'm sure Save Ohio Parks will continue to watch this very closely and be outspoken against it. They have been, following this very closely since that law was signed by Governor DeWine.
Well, coming up, we are going to talk about Ohio's election. We will have a new governor elected in about 4 months. So we're going to check in on the campaign, some of the emerging issues and more. That is when the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service, Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We are 4 months away from the November election and the governor's race between Republican nominee Vivek Ramaswamy and Democrat Amy Acton is getting national attention. For Ohio voters, it will be an historic pick. The first non-white male if Ramaswamy wins, the first woman elected if Acton wins, the first non-Christian either way. Ramaswamy is Hindu and Acton is Jewish. Jeremy, can you give us a sense of how they're campaigning at this stage of the game? Is it shaping up like traditional campaigns of the past, or are things more intense? It used to be a long time ago that summer was slow, and I feel like it's not slow.
Knock on wood, because we'll see if this continues. But right now, it's a little slower. They're not to say they're not doing anything. Ramaswamy and Acton are both campaigning around. They were both in 4th of July parades, for example, over the weekend. I think there's two, when you have any statewide campaign like this, there's kind of, it's like a seesaw. The first half, you're raising money and trying to get endorsements and doing all this behind the scenes stuff. And then at some point, it just shifts over to the other side, and then the other side goes down, and then they start spending the money and really going around the state. I think we're on the cusp of that happening. Ramaswamy has been airing ads, but it's mainly because he has so much money that he's has the ability to air ads this early. I think sometime next month is when we'll see the campaign really start, that seesaw really shift over, and we'll see that a barrage of ads, and we won't be able to go anywhere in Ohio without seeing at least one of these two.
We are actually are getting the barrage of ads, though, because Ramaswamy is spending a lot of money in his super PAC, the VPAC, Victors, not Victims. They've been spending millions of dollars. I think some of the other groups are starting to get involved. You're going to definitely see it starting in September. The Democratic Governors Association has already at least $10 million, I think. They've got millions of dollars of ad time starting in September that they're going to be running right through Election Day. So you'll start seeing all theirs.
Not to mention the Acton campaign.
And the Acton campaign. Right now is state fair season. So they're hitting all the state fairs right now. Ramaswamy's using that to kind of, as an attack against Acton as her time as health director, kind of saying, you know, a few years ago during COVID, she shut down all the state fairs and that. So you're seeing them hit, you know, the parade circuit, the state fair circuit. You're going to start seeing them more and more on the air, more public facing events too.
Jeremy, talk to me about whether these ads need to be attack ads or are the candidates trying to still introduce themselves to Ohio? Because neither of them have run for office before.
As Shane said, so far it's mostly one-sided. It's mostly Ramaswamy and pro-Ramaswamy allies doing the ad buying right now. But so far there's some like introducing the candidate ads, but a large chunk of them are attack ads. And that reflects how this is a competitive race, or at least Ramaswamy and his allies see it as a competitive race, that they're going after Acton. You know, this is a different kind of campaign than Ohio normally has, because neither of these two have held elected office before. And so a lot of it is, you know, they say in politics you want to define your opponent before they can define themselves. And so that is what a lot of this is trying to, people know who Amy Acton is, excuse me, from her time as state health director, and people know who Vivek Ramaswamy is from his time running for president in 2024. But in terms of what they would do as governor, that's what they're really trying to do, is define, hey, as governor, this, my opponent would do this. Oh, no.
Yeah. And Sarah, I've heard, like, on this show before, and then also at Politics in a Pint, our event recently, you've said that you take polls at this point with a grain of salt. But the polling is showing them, like, in a dead heat, if not Acton winning by like one percentage point or something like that. Yeah,
I feel like I give this caveat all the time. I take polls always with a grain of salt, even if it's days before the election, because they're simply a snapshot in time. I think they've undercaptured Trump voters and Republican voters in Ohio, especially in recent election cycles. You've seen, you know, in the primary, for example, Matt Dolan polling like right in line with Bernie Moreno, and then Bernie Moreno went on to crush Matt Dolan in the primary. So they're a snapshot in time. I always remind people of that. But I think Ramaswamy's actions show, A, like Jeremy said, that he has a lot of money, but B, that his campaign is at least taking the race seriously. I think if they thought it was going to be no contest at all, I don't know that we'd be seeing ads run during Cincinnati Reds games on a Saturday. That's not cheap ad space, to my understanding. So I think those actions show that the polls are probably at least an accurate-ish snapshot in time of how people are feeling right now.
And especially attack ads, too, because normally if you're really ahead in the race, traditional political wisdom is you don't mention your opponent at all. Like, don't give them any free publicity, positive or negative. But the fact that Ramaswamy's and his allies are going after Acton and bringing her up frequently shows that they consider this to be, you know, a competitive race, as Sarah said.
And again, taking what Sarah said, take those polls with the caveat of they're just a snapshot in time. But the good news for Acton is, despite over a month, maybe 2 months of attack ads against her, she's still polling about even with Ramaswamy at this point. So that's got to be good news for her campaign, especially in a state that seems to be going more red in the last few election cycles.
And I think the question, too, is I think it's the question that's on every reporter's mind and everyone who's watching this race closely's mind is how much does COVID really matter here? I mean, I think that, you know, there's been
it was 6
so
years
much,
ago. Yeah.
There's been so much focus from Ramaswamy's campaign right now. And of course, that's why Ohioans know Amy Acton. If they know Amy Acton, there's been so much focus on that COVID piece and less on the like she's a the other attack lines that Republicans around the country are taking, which she's the Democratic socialist. I mean, there's been some of that too, but I think that focus that Shane mentioned about like all these county fairs and Acton shut down your county fairs, I wonder how much it plays with voters.
And that's been an interesting part of me as an observer of this whole campaign is how much is COVID going to play into it? Because that's a time in our lives when a lot of people would like to forget about it. So
yeah, maybe quit bringing it up.
Yeah. So is it going to be, you know, by attacking Acton and her time as health director, are you going to then associate all those negative feelings you have about COVID with her? Or are you, like Sarah said, I just want to move on with my life.
Well, and Governor DeWine has even said associate it with him, not her, because the buck stopped with him.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't directly come out and said, Amy Acton's the best. And of course, we should
but
Governor DeWine did endorse Vivek Ramaswamy.
Right. But he signed the shutdown orders. Yeah,
he's been very clear about that it was not just an Amy Acton. I mean, there's so many interesting factors when you go to this race and how it connects to COVID, because then you look at the Senate race and John Husted was lieutenant governor at that point, and he's painted it as, well, Governor DeWine was kind of in the middle and Amy Acton was, you know, pushing for the shutdowns and I was pushing to open things up. So it's funny that these races in Ohio are truly like a throwback to 2020, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Well, as I mentioned, this race is getting some national attention. Both candidates are giving interviews to national outlets, and I wanted to play some recent audio clips from each of them and then we can discuss after we listen. So this is Ramaswamy on Fox News a couple of weeks ago. He was asked to comment about Elon Musk, his former Doge partner, the Department of Government Efficiency. Elon Musk achieved trillionaire status, and here's what Ramaswamy said.
So you think about the greatness of America. It's capitalism. It's the rule of law. It's the fact that we're a magnet for the best around the world. That is what got us here. And certainly you have the left-wing socialists. They're becoming more and more popular. They're winning primary elections. You're seeing it even this season. I have no hope for the Democrat Party. They're going nowhere. But what I want to see is a Republican Party that once again embraces this idea of celebrating success rather than villainizing it.
So, Jeremy, what stands out to you about that audio? You know, Elon Musk became a trillionaire. We should celebrate success and not villainize it.
That's become a more commonly used line by Ramaswamy as Amy Acton's campaign has gone after him
for
being
money.
A billionaire.
Yeah.
They're claiming he's an out-of-touch billionaire. They're pointing to his use of a private jet to campaign around the state and take these trips, out of the country. And so his response to that is, you know, well, they're villainizing success, that, you know, that people like me can become wealthy, and that's part of the American dream. And by going after it, you're villainizing success. So that's fits hand in glove with what he's been saying in general in response to Amy Acton.
Before I play Amy Acton, Shane or Sarah, do you want to weigh in on what Ramaswamy just said? All right. So next, I want to play a cut from Acton. She was on MSN Now. So each candidate appeared on friendly media outlets. This interview is a part of a segment on how Ohio is one of the states to watch with these races. Let's listen.
And everywhere we go, we see record crowds of people showing up. It doesn't know party. And people are feeling the effects of these policies. They're working harder than they ever have. And the cost thing, it's just all not adding up. And they're exhausted of the hate and the chaos and the vitriol and being pitted against one another. I can tell you, without a doubt, Ohioans are ready for a change.
And Sarah, what stands out for you in that messaging there, the change message? Is that going to resonate for voters?
I mean, I think it's, I think it's a little too early to tell, but we'll have to see because, I think both candidates have been giving these looser quotes about change and this is where the direction that Ohio needs to go in. But I think it's been pointed out before that neither of them have these like bulleted platforms of what comes next.
And yeah, Shane or Jeremy, do you want to weigh in on this idea of Acton saying that Ohioans are exhausted by hate and chaos? I when I think DeWine, I'm not thinking hate and chaos, but anyway.
I think it's also Acton trying to be in the middle on this. You know, mm-hmm. she said she wants to, you know, she points out a lot that she worked for a Republican administration and I've worked with both sides. And she's also said she wants to, you know, appoint Republicans to her cabinet. So I think this is her trying to come off as a centrist. You know, one of the things that we see a lot of these days in campaigns is you really want to paint the other side as just very extreme. And I'm the person who's going to kind of keep things low key in the middle.
Is she trying loosely to tie Ramaswamy to Trump without saying because, right? Jeremy?
That's part of it. I'm smiling when I listened to that because it kind of she did a good job of kind of hitting multiple different campaign angles that she's been trying to push. One of them is that she's the affordability candidate, that I'll lower your cost of living. Another is that I'm a moderate and I will appoint a Republican to my cabinet. And that's reflects a need among Amy Acton to win over Republicans, that if, in a state where Republicans have controlled all three branches of state government for more than a decade, she's going to need Republicans to vote for her or at least stay home and not vote for Ramaswamy. So it clicks that. And it's just a political truism that the change candidate wins elections. And so both Amy Acton and Ramaswamy have been campaigning as the quote unquote change candidates. It's a little bit more hard to square that circle for Ramaswamy, given that Republicans have already controlled state government and he's a Republican. But he's tried to make that clear on issues like Medicaid fraud and separating himself from Governor DeWine and other Republicans to present himself as the change candidate.
And I thought it was interesting, you know, these Supreme Court, federal Supreme Court rulings came down last week on a bunch of different issues. But one of the issues was on transgender girls playing in girls' sports. And Amy Acton, you know, said boys shouldn't be able to play in girls' sports on Twitter, which is not something that I would have, you know, placed on a Democrat a couple of years ago. You know, Democrats in the state legislature voted against the ban on transgender kids playing in girls' sports. So, you know, Acton certainly caught I've seen some flack from some of the left factions on that. So, you know, it's certainly that they both have to, and she has the harder lift, like Jeremy said, of appealing to these centrist Republicans who maybe don't want to vote for Ramaswamy, or on the flip side, that hope that maybe some of these folks on the far right who have qualms about voting for Ramaswamy just don't show up.
Well, Democrats have been criticized for focusing on niche issues like trans rights, as an example, instead of focusing on what matters to more Ohioans, like a bigger population, with economic issues and affordability, instead of honing in on, you know, something like that. So does anyone have an assessment of like Democratic leadership in the state, messaging focus from the Ohio Democratic Party?
Yeah, I can talk about that. Just to go back to what Sarah talked about, if you recall, the transgender issue came up in the Senate race in 2024. They had really started attacking Sherrod Brown to the point where he had to put out an ad that says, no, this is not the way I view things. So the thought is that Amy Acton came out with that statement to try and get ahead of that, because that will probably come up again. Democrats are trying to go, we're the affordability party. This is the biggest concern on a lot of people's minds. This is, everybody's struggling these days. I've heard Kathleen Clyde, the Ohio Democratic Party chair, every time she's given a speech, she talks affordability, affordability, affordability. Amy Acton's talking about affordability, affordability, affordability. You see that coming from the National Democrats. That's where they want to keep bringing it back to, because they believe that's their winning message.
Before we take the break, just quickly, Jeremy, Cleveland.com is doing a series of stories on key issues in the governor's race. Your most recent piece was related to transportation funding and highway projects. I mean, do you feel like Ramaswamy and Acton have strong proposed remedies for things like this?
They don't. So when I opposed to both campaigns, so to back up,
yeah,
there, Ohio and Governor Mike DeWine's administration specifically has been looking at there's a disturbing trend for transportation funding because there's more fuel-efficient vehicles on the road, more electric hybrid vehicles. And so gas tax revenue, even though it was raised in 2019, has plateaued and it hasn't come in. It hasn't raised as much money as they expected it to. Mm. And at the same time, thanks to inflation, not just general inflation, but specifically construction cost inflation within the industry, especially like with the bipartisan infrastructure law, there's a big demand now for raw materials, labor, etc. So they're warning that by like 2040, 2050, there's going to be a real problem with raising enough money just with gas tax, which pays for about 40% of highway projects, to fill that hole. So DeWine's administration is they've been looking at things like setting up toll booths around interstate highways around the state, or non-interstate highways too. They've been looking at raising the gas tax or charging a mileage fee. So every mile you drive in Ohio, you would have to pay a tax on that. They're just looking at that. This is early stages. But then asking Ramaswamy and Acton about that, Ramaswamy's campaign answered basically that he would cut administrative waste and government bloat. Well, what does that mean? We don't know. And Acton's campaign was more forthright. They said, she said, according to the campaign, that she would not favor tolling. She would not favor raising the gas tax. But beyond that, she would work with public and private partners to look at finding ways to address this. So she was a bit more forthcoming, but as far as exactly what either campaign would do remains to be seen.
She's going to give naming rights to the highways, right? And they're going to have maybe that's a way to get some private money on a highway.
We can auction them off fracking stuff.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and coming up, we're going to talk about the latest with SNAP benefits and what recent Supreme Court decisions mean for Ohio. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. When it comes to SNAP benefits or food stamp assistance, federal law now penalizes states with an error rate above 6%. By requiring them for the first time to pay a portion of the benefits. And Shane, your colleague Noah Blundo wrote about this. Ohio's rate is above that threshold, but officials have been working to bring it down. What steps have Ohio officials taken to lower the error rate? They're trying to get below that 6%.
They're doing more thorough reviews to try and see if there's places that need to be fixed. This goes back to the One Big Beautiful Bill, the One Big Beautiful Act, or also House Resolution 1. So that required states in either federal fiscal year 25 or federal fiscal year 26 to get their payment error rate down below 6%. If they don't do so, they're going to have to pay more, because under the SNAP program, the federal government picks up a large chunk of that. Well, if a lot of that money is going out the door due to payment errors, either somebody overcharging you or just people getting benefits that probably should not have gotten benefits in that case, then that's going to, you know, that's less money that's supposed to be going into it. So states with an error rate of above 6% will be required to pick up 5% of the benefit costs. Under what Ohio has, that was about $161 million last year. States above 10% will have to pay 10% of the benefit costs. And then those above 10% would have to pay 15%. The USDA just put out the latest numbers. Ohio's right now about 6.76%, so it's getting closer to that, but they're not quite below that. You know, that's better than it was in fiscal year 25, or I'm sorry, I think it was 24. They were about 9% in Ohio. In 23, it was about 7.1% in 22. So they weren't calculated earlier in the decade because of COVID. So they're every state's going through this process. And the other thing that a lot of states are doing, and some of the, you know, associations that represent lawmakers and governors, they're actually trying to push Congress too, to kind of pass something to kind of delay this a little bit, saying we're addressing this problem, but can you give us a little more wiggle room? Because this fall is when the next federal fiscal year ends, and this is when they need to get to below 6%, or else they're going to have to start paying.
Okay. So it sounds like Ohio's close, though, 6.7%. So they're getting there. They're doing
It's gradual, and there's a question, can you ever truly get below that number?
Yeah.
And I'll be curious to see, you know, SNAP benefits in Ohio are administered at the county level, not at the state level. And Ohio's in the minority there. A lot of other states do statewide benefit agencies. So I know that some lawmakers have floated maybe looking at taking that administration away from the counties, because they say, well, the state's on the hook for the money, so maybe we need to be the ones
so the counties are making the errors and the state collects all the information or something.
It's a little more complicated than that, obviously. The state, the counties are administering it on behalf of the state, but on behalf of the federal government.
Yeah.
But you know, I know lawmakers have floated a potential, you know, overhaul of how these benefits are actually administered.
Well, and one thing to add is there, like, it's not related to error so much as fraud, but we're finally going to move from the swipe cards to the chip cards. And I had Matt Damschroeder from the Department of Job and Family Services on, saying that a big part of the fraud rates is because swipe cards are so easily hacked. So I guess we're finally moving to the chip card. So maybe that'll even help with the error rate a little bit. I don't know. No, you don't know.
I honestly, I'm not sure. Jeremy's nodding.
Sure.
I think that's,
it can't hurt.
I think that's been something that's been pushed for a while. It's not directly tied to
any of this, yeah.
The funding issue, but it's also going to affect the funding issue. I think that's part of it. It's just a general security measure.
Yeah, it's expensive, though, to change all the cards from, yeah.
Sure, but then if you're looking to get it down below 6%, that's seen as something that would help then.
You're listening to All Sides, and this is our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking with Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, Shane Stegmiller with Hanna News Service, and Sarah Donaldson with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Sarah, I wanted to circle back to a topic that we discussed last week, but it was a complicated thing, and the reporters were not very up to date on the topic. It was sub-metering.
oh, God.
I know. So I was wondering, because you did write the story about sub-metering, and the governor vetoed a bill related to it. So are you able to explain sub-metering and why the governor vetoed it?
I'm going to try my best, yeah. And my wonderful State House reporter colleagues can, you know, hit me if I'm doing it wrong.
We struggled last week, so maybe.
So
yeah.
Basically, you know, sub-metering is this idea that maybe it's a landlord, some sort of third party, a middleman, is coming and buying electric or another utility at wholesale cost, and then they're reselling it. So it's very common in apartment complexes, condominiums. Let's try that again. Condos. My apologies, listeners. It's very common in multi-tenant housing. Mm-hmm. So often landlords or some other building manager are maybe buying it and reselling it, calculating based on tenant usage. But the problem has been how to regulate it, because the PUCO, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, has said before that they don't necessarily see submetering as a utility. So utility companies like AEP of Ohio are regulated like public utilities. Mm-hmm. And because they're regulated, they have to abide by certain standards. They can't just disconnect people if they're not paying their bills. They have to go through a certain level of
there are protections for consumers of utilities from getting disconnected. There are payment plans if they can't necessarily afford that utility, but that doesn't exist for submetering. So for these customers who are submetered, they are not being afforded the same protections. At least that's the argument that the Ohio Consumers Council and other groups have made. So it went all the way up to the Ohio Supreme Court. I don't know all the way up. I think it was not that many steps to get there, but they reversed the PUCO decision and said submetering companies are utilities and they should be regulated as such. So there was this bill that was also passed that would have regulated submetering companies, but it would not have provided the same level of protections, at least that's what I'm told by the Consumers Council, that this Supreme Court decision affords. Because now the Supreme Court is basically saying to the PUCO, you need to regulate these companies like you regulate AEP of Ohio. And that bill that was regulating submetering companies kind of made two different classes. There were less protections afforded. So DeWine vetoed it, arguing that although he appreciates that lawmakers were also, you know, concerned about this issue and putting forward regulations with that Supreme Court decision, this would have kind of backtracked.
Okay, so he's saying lawmakers' bill wasn't good enough compared to the Supreme Court decision.
Basically, and okay. That's the argument of the Consumers Council, who has been pushing really hard on this. And I will say there were Democrats who voted against this submetering regulation bill, because there were more than one bill that was trying to regulate submetering, and this was the one that was pushed forward. And again, the argument of those who voted against it was it just didn't go far enough. So I hope I did okay.
You
Sorry
did a great job.
Sub-ups.
No, I understand it now. And now I understand why you vetoed it. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
All right. So they had to try again, I guess, if the Supreme Court said they need to do something.
Yeah. And I talked to the Consumers Council and they said, really, they don't think that lawmakers need to do anything here.
The PUCO needs
to handle it based on the Supreme Court decision. But the PUCO is the one that is the expert on how to regulate utilities. So it's the opinion of the Consumers Council. That's the agency that kind of pushes for consumers' rights when it comes to utilities. They say, really, lawmakers don't need to get involved here because that Supreme Court decision does what they wanted it to do.
And meanwhile, state lawmakers who favor it, the Republican co-sponsors of the bill, say that it's needed because, well, the PUCO, a future PUCO, could reinterpret what this means. And so we need to put some consumer protections in state law for submetering.
Oh, I see.
And while it doesn't go, as Sarah said, it doesn't go as far enough as it would be under now, thanks to the Ohio Supreme Court decision, they'd say, well, it would create some consumer protections and those would be codified in state law as opposed to just being a Supreme Court ruling.
And I will note that submetering companies, I think, were a little more for the bill that DeWine vetoed. So we'll just add that
Take that for what it's worth. All right.
Yes.
Okay, Shane, we are running out of time, but I did talk about this at the very top of the show. So I wanted to ask you about a U.S. Supreme Court case related to needing a permit to pray in a home. And I believe your colleague Noah Blundo might have written about this, but it's a case that involves a Jewish man from Northeast Ohio, Daniel Grand, and he was required by city officials to have a permit to have a prayer group in his home, and it happened in 2022, and now it's all the way before the U.S. Supreme Court. So can you explain this, why there was a permit needed and how it reached the high court?
So this Daniel Grand is a Orthodox Jew, and this goes back to 2021. He organized a group to pray at his home because under his Orthodox Judaism, he must pray three times a day with at least 10 other men in observance of Shabbos, which lasts from sunset Friday until stars emerge on Saturday night. And those who observe are not allowed to travel by car. Well, the closest synagogue to him is quite a ways away, and it was going to be hard for him to walk. So he started organizing these prayers and prayer groups in his home. Mm-hmm. Neighbors started complaining about it. So the city came to him and said, no, you need to get a permit as if you are a synagogue.
Oh.
So he originally started the process to get a permit. But when they were hearing the permit through the city, there was a lot of people who came out in opposition and seeing what was going on. He pulled the permit. But then he turned around and filed a federal lawsuit saying, you're treating what I'm doing in my home different than what you would treat any other kind of gathering in a home, and that's unconstitutional. That goes against my First Amendment rights. the story that went through, he filed a federal lawsuit. So the lower courts dismissed the case because they said you pulled the permit before it, you know, had a chance to even get heard, approved or denied. So therefore, you have no course of action. So now it's gone up to the Supreme Court, who's going to just kind of take a look at the whole entire case. I'm assuming they're going to go a little further than just whether or not he should have gone through the process of getting a permit. They might look at the whole issue of whether or not a city can require somebody holding a prayer group at home like they're a synagogue.
All right. Well, that'll be one to watch, but thank you for explaining it. And this has been our weekly reporter roundtable. So thank you, Shane Stegmiller, reporter with Hannah News Service. Thanks for being here, Shane.
Thank you.
And Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Amy.
And Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thank you.
Thanks.
This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.